Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Questlove Supreme. I'm your host, Questlove. With us, we have Fragmented Supremers. We got Fontigo in the house. What's up, brother?
I'm still here, man. What up, what up, what up?
We're here. Sugar Steve.
Yep, I'm not fragmented. I've never missed a show, except the ones you told me not to attend.
Wait, when did I ban you, Steve?
That purple round table joint.
Oh, you're holding that against me?
Yes, but let's move on. Yeah.
Shots fired in the intro. Ladies and gentlemen, I will say that our guests have single-handedly at least changed, and I'm making this introduction personal. I'm making it about me, not about you or the audience. I'll say that our guests today have single-handedly probably changed my trajectory or changed my perspective on how to deliver music. And that's pretty much all I can say. I heard their debut album, and it just cracked my skull. It cracked all of our skulls open in a way that really hasn't done that probably since the days of prime Bomb Squad productions of like Public Enemy and Ice Cube, or even the Three Feet High and Rising and De La Soul's Dead albums of the early 90s. I'll say that Rick Rubin has taught us on the show that editing is necessary for smart pop music making. And, you know, the ability to leave the basic necessities for, you know, for the most part of that theory, you know, with self-editing has worked miracles for pop music in the last 70 years. But our guests have done the opposite of that. And they've left no stone unturned as far as a sonic landscape. Their forever classic debut album, now 20 years old, called Since I Left You, is probably, personally, one of my top 10 favorite albums of all times. With over 1,000 mind-staggering samples and sound bites, we all got to investigate how this was made. When we found out that they wanted to come on the show, it was an instant yes on my part.
Same here, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just honored they're here to share their story with us, because I don't even know if I can properly explain to you how important their art is. But ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to Questlove Supreme, the Avalanches. We have Robbie and Tony. Robbie, what's your last name?
Chaita.
Robbie Chaita.
Chaita.
Okay. Welcome, Robbie Chaita and Tony DeBlasi to Questlove Supreme.
Thank you.
Where are you right now?
We're in Melbourne.
How is it over there right now?
Yeah, it's pretty good. We had like a really hard lockdown last year, but we're coming out of it now, which is really good. And we just played our first live show in, you know, 3 years on Friday.
Wow. So really? What was that like, man?
Yeah. Oh, it was incredible. It was so amazing, you know, just to be with the people again. And, you know, I don't know. It just felt like at the start, it felt really strange. Like, you know, it's a little bit rusty, but then you kind of get into it for 20 minutes and you're like, oh, I remember what it's like. And instead of being scared, it's like this joyous experience. And yeah, I mean, we've just missed it so much. So it was so good.
So it's hard, like working your muscle memory for what the show was when you, well, with this particular show, was it crafted from scratch, or was it the show that you were developing around the time when COVID first hit us?
No, it was from scratch. So it was a lot. It was like our hometown, first show back, brand new show. All the equipment too has been like in storage and all covered in dust. And, you know, it was like everybody was like
family, you know, and friends.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had a few technical issues that we were. That seems like whenever there's a first show, there's always a few things that go down or go wrong. But in the end, it was really incredible, and we got so much love from the audience. And
I would imagine that the amount of research that you have to put into your product, as far as your creativity is concerned, that, I mean, was this time off with COVID, was it a total 100% time off for you guys, or was it just like, okay, let's go back to Woodshed and create new product, or did you just stop, period, and just, you know, kind of see what happens until the world opens?
It was tough. I mean, we were finishing an album as COVID hit, and we kind of got that done and got that ready to go. But like Melbourne's lockdown, we were in it for like 200 days. It was one of the hardest lockdowns in the world, and you couldn't, you could only leave your house for an hour a day. There was a curfew in the evenings. Couldn't
so
go more than
8 p.m. till 5 a.m. You couldn't go outside your house.
Well, you guys did it right. You actually did it right. And, you know, the world would have actually caught up to you guys. And, you know, because after some point, once we saw your numbers go down, and then like a whole bunch of movie productions and a lot of my friends in the industry were going to melt, you know, going over there to Australia, to New Zealand, over
New
there
Zealand,
because
yeah.
you guys were just doing it right. So, but you had to be strict with it.
We had to be strict. I mean, the payoff was like we got to do a show, you know, like now, you know, and things are opening up. But at the time it was hard. And like we thought, well, we've got all this free time, we'll be creative. But it was pretty intense. And the city was, you know, a ghost town. And really it made me learn how much that we rely on the collective energy and other people to feed our creativity. So even though we had all this spare time, like we didn't write a lot last year because it was just kind of getting through day by day. You know, the lockdown was
hard.
And very uninspiring.
Well, I was going to say, you know, I still want to jump right to Since I Left You, but I do, because I don't know about you guys personally, I do want to know the origins of the group and of you two musically before you even, like, what built to that moment. Could you just give us a basic kind of an overlay of what your lives were into creatively, like growing up? Well, both of you were DJs for starters. Like, what got you interested in DJ culture? Like, how did it hit you over there?
We actually, we grew up in different suburbs of Melbourne, and then both ended up in the same country town during high school, and that's where we met and became friends. And we weren't DJs initially. We were like bad punk musicians.
We say punk because we were so bad at playing. Yeah.
Well, it was noise.
It's kind of like the Beastie Boys story. Like,
I was about to say it's Beastie Boys, yeah.
Yeah. They start off punk and then, you know.
That's right. And we were just, I mean, I had no money or whatever. So we were buying old guitars and broken guitars and organs in junk stores. And then we started to find all these old records, and it just sort of grew from there. I was doing a film school course at university, and they had a big studio for all the film scores. And of course, everybody doing that course wanted to be like a famous director, so nobody wanted to do the soundtrack. So I just had the studio to myself for like 3 years, and there was an old Ensoniq sampler in there that I learned how to use and started sampling all these junk store records, and it just grew from there, really. Yeah.
So how old were you when you made the transition to DJ-oriented music, like away from punk and more into what we now know as DJ culture?
I guess it was like a gradual process between the ages of like 16 and 20.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Was there a particular record that just spoke to you that said like, okay, this is the direction I want to go personally? For both of you, was there like one particular album that was...
Like for me, it was like some of Prince Paul's productions, the Bomb Squad, the things you mentioned. Actually.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw Prince Paul. He just remixed Since I Left You. I was listening to it earlier.
Yeah.
And because, you know, like the records we were finding in junk stores were just strange, weird records. They weren't like sort of cool. Like a lot of the beautiful funk and soul records from the States never made it out here, you know. So we were, they were junk store records.
A lot of lounge music.
Exotica and strange stuff like that. And Prince Paul, I think, showed us that, you know, you can use anything and you can make music with humor from all these different bits and pieces. And we were like, oh, we can do that, you know. And also we love like the Beach Boys and 70s rock and stuff. So we thought, imagine if we like take his sort of approach, but like try and make like pop songs with it. And that's how the whole idea began.
So how did you two meet each other?
At high school.
We met in high school. I I was from Melbourne, and at 18 went and moved to this country town where I met Robbie, and it was a very, very for the early 90s, very backward kind of place, like country Victoria. And so it was just like a lot of football players, and they were all the cool people and stuff like that. And like, so the music, people who are into music kind of gravitated to each other. So we kind of started hanging out. And then the first thing I remember about Robbie was, like, I was into all types of music, but he played me My Bloody Valentine, and that just kind of broke my brain of like, what the hell is this? And I was like, all right, this is really cool. I think I like this guy. I think I like his taste in music. And so from then on, we kind of, you know, just had a few other little small bands that we were in. And then we both moved back down to Melbourne and started, you know, doing the punk thing just in our lounge room really badly. And it just kind of grew from there.
Were y'all any of y'all folks involved in music in any way, or what did your parents do?
No, I mean, my father was a printer. My mum was a teacher, but I do remember being fascinated with my father's record collection when I was a little kid. And when he would let me, like, you know, handle the records, I, you know, obsessed with the liner notes, and, you know, he was like into like the band and Bob Dylan and Neil Young and Joni Mitchell and all that stuff. So
single songwriter stuff.
That's right.
Gotcha.
I know that because you guys developed early, like pre 93, 94 is when you guys first started. So without sort of like culture colonialism, well, not culture colonialism, but just the idea of, like, you know, now with the internet, someone could release something and the entire world get it at the same time, where, you know, really before 1997, like, just, it was regionalism, like certain parts of the world had certain types of music and whatnot. Now, I know for Australia, kind of the inside joke, and again, this is before like the age of the internet spreading, becoming law, like a lot of groups that were wildly popular from America, from that were wildly popular in Australia, really weren't that big in America. And I always wanted to know, I never got to talk to anyone like specifically from Australia or New Zealand to find out why. Like, I'll say that there was a point where like the Jurassic Five, pre-Fergie, Black Eyed Peas, Ben Harper, like those acts could damn near sell out stadiums. And we'd hear it about in the United States, like, yo, man, do you know the Black Eyed Peas could sell out a stadium in Australia? You're like, get the fuck out of here. Like, and this is, again, back when they were just like a club act, like a bar act, you know, that sort of thing. But what is it I noticed with Australia, especially for their embracing of like soul music? Like, you guys have that big giant soul festival down there where, you know, you guys have this festival for soul music that's sort of like Coachella, but it's just like all neo soul artists. And even now, everybody from Kimbra, like, and again, I've my friends have told me that, you know, New Zealand and Australia, like, we tend to lump just that entire area one thing, but, you know, I see it as New Jersey. Right. And you guys are like, no, we're not the same, but there's so many like-minded cool artists from down there that were like influenced by like a certain type of soul music that's very niche to us here. Like, what's the radio like there? Like, what is it that turned people on to that particular type of soul music? Whereas now, years later, like, a lot of these acts are coming out that are like really incredible, like Hiatus Coyote I can name a billion, but what is it about? What was the music atmosphere like?
It's a rock culture, I would say, like when we were starting out. So it's like there's the pub venues, you know, there's a very heavy drinking culture in Australia. There's the pub venues, and all the bands that we grew up with came through this pub scene. It's like hard rock and roll, like AC/DC and this kind of thing. I guess there's the Bad Seeds, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds as well. Or the Birthday Party came out of that sort of dark pub scene as well in Melbourne. But then something started to change in the 90s, exactly like you're talking about. And I think it was just, it was pre-internet, but people just this passion for music that wasn't like that. And something just started beautiful, just started to grow. I don't know how it happened.
But it was very, very, like when we started playing, every band we played with was just two guitars, bass player, drums. And so we'd rock up with a sampler and the sound people were like, what's this? What are we doing? And right. No one knew what it was. So I was like, in that way, we were kind of breaking ground in this country as far as like, every little festival we'd do, it was like every band's the same guitar, drums, everything like that. And then we just have, S900 sampler and some shitty organs that work sometimes and didn't. And so, to your question, it was a very rock and roll culture back then in Australia.
So it was the Akai S900, was that your weapon of choice at the time? The Akai joint?
That was the jam, yeah.
A 900?
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Because then they came with the 950. The 950, I think that was the one that the Supreme used to use, the 950. But I remember the 900.
Oh, we were loading off the songs off floppy disk when we played live. Every song was on a different floppy disk.
So we'd stop a song and then have to load for 45 seconds and just sit there in silence. Or just try and make up some stupid banter in between. Like,
how's everyone doing?
Again.
Go right. Coast in the house. You guys and D'Angelo. Okay, that's good to know. To this day, D'Angelo still uses floppy disk. I didn't even know that.
Oh, wow.
That still exists.
I didn't know they still made them, yeah.
Do you know how hard
he has zip drives, floppy disks.
Really?
Yeah, we had to search the internet to find floppy disks.
For the show we just did.
Wait, so to this day you still use it? That's your weapon of choice?
We wanted to pull out the old samplers for this show that we just did. So we wanted to bring back and really show how we made the music, but we couldn't find floppy disks anywhere. Tony had to order them online and they arrived like 2 days before the show just in time. So
wow.
Really?
We're not using that. We're kind of using computers and now as our main backing track. So we're not relying on the 45-second loads anymore. But we use the samplers just to trigger samples during the show because that's the way we used to do it. It's such a fun, it's a fun way to do it.
What was the period of which you guys discovered, like, breakbeat culture and as far as, like, at least I would like to think that you guys, had to put a lot of time in researching, like, all the sounds and for your arsenal of sounds, your drums, your samples and whatnot. So at what point did you guys discover, or at least like do away with kind of your rock backdrop and get to what we know as like breakbeat culture?
I think it was like a gradual process. And all of a sudden we realized like I think we had, all these big sounds and big dreams in our heads, but no money. And then you start sampling an old orchestral record, because a lot of the records that we were finding in junk stores were like schmaltzy kind of like junk, like fifth Andre Kostelanitz strings and
James Last,
all that stuff. But we could find beautiful little bits and then realize we can create these big sounds with from a $2 record. And we gradually realized, look, we're not great musicians at guitar and we can't sing, but maybe we can invent our own little world if we just use samples. And it sort of grew from there. And then a whole bunch of records were coming out, like the Dust Brothers produced the Dust Brothers record. Mm-hmm. And there were the early Chemical Brothers records, and all these records had breakbeats. There was
DJ Shadow.
De La Soul, and even like the Far Side records and all these kind of early hip hop records. And we kind of in our head, it's because we're so geographically removed from the rest of the world, we would just get strange little influences coming through before the internet. So in some way, weird way, like a bit of Prince Paul, a bit of the Bomb Squad, a bit of the Beach Boys, a bit of My Bloody Valentine all kind of made sense to us. And we just kind of started developing our own sound from there.
When you formed the group, was it instantaneous that you called yourself the Avalanches, or were you just like, DJ Robbie, DJ Tony, 49 FM, Down Under?
No, we had a few name incarnations before we came up with the Avalanches.
The Avalanches name was actually on was a surf rock group from the 50s, one of these bands we sampled, and we used to change our name every time we played, and that one just stuck.
So. Oh, it just stuck?
Yeah.
Oh, just randomly you just decided to
maybe we had a good gig the day that we called ourselves the Avalanches and we went, oh, maybe this is an omen. We'll stick with this name. Because I think we had a few gigs where we were different names. So,
what was the first product that you guys worked on when you decided to form the Avalanches?
It was like, I think it was a mixtape we made in the studio I was talking about at the film school studio that was made to send around to various promoters to try and get a gig, try and get shows. Mm-hmm. And then I think they pulled a couple of tracks off that and our friend put it out as our first 7-inch. It was called Rock City. Yeah, I think that was the first release we ever did, a 7-inch record.
Yeah, even then, like, was your theory, what was the theory based on how to create the music? I know a lot of times, especially with where we are today with hip hop culture in America, you know, and I won't say that flipping samples, of course, you know, flipping is a way of survival to at least avoid, you know, lawsuits or getting caught out there. But I mean, there's definitely a slew of producers that flip just for the sport of it, you know, especially like these post Jay Dilla times where he could take something, make it so unrecognizable that you don't know it. So, but for you guys, like, were you guys even aware of kind of sample culture, almost being an endangered species in the mid to late 90s, to the point where, you know, now a lot of the backdrop from America is far from that. But were you guys aware of it then, or was it just, you know,
Well, I think we were aware that records that were made in that way that were rare and were, and you know, to find them, they were like sort of these gems that would stick out. Like if a well-made sample-based record is just like such a beautiful thing, and they don't come along all the time, you know. But we kind of thought, no, like we're a million miles from anywhere. No one's ever going to hear this. So we can just sample anything and it's never going to matter. We were just doing it for ourselves.
Well, yeah. Famous last words.
Bro. No, wait, Fonte, I was going to say, it's funny that he said that all the way in Australia, because that's also where I was when I decided to play Really Love, because I didn't understand. I didn't realize
this is going everywhere. Yeah,
yeah, I thought I was on some like local underground radio station that the world wouldn't hear of, and then that shit happened. Yeah,
we've kind of got the same attitude to samples of just like, oh, we'll just use it and see what happens.
Nobody will know.
No, it's quite soft in the mix, right? You can't tell.
Okay, so let's we're 25 minutes in. Let's cut to the goddamn chase.
How?
Right. That's my first question.
Yeah.
How? Can you tell us the story of Since I Left You? And it's hard to explain. It's really hard. Even when, you know, that album's so perfect to me that even when I explain to people who are, you know, just casual music listeners, like they're still not getting the genius that every last thing you hear had to be manipulated and edited in a way so that it fits melodically, structurally.
Yeah.
So tell us the beginning of how you guys even thought to make this classic album.
I think I'll let Tony jump in, but we were kind of doing gigs in these rock venues. We're using samplers, and our friend Darren would MC over the top, and we had some live drums. Yeah. And then as we got into the studio more, we realized it sounds so much cooler if we just remove ourselves from it, you know, remove our voices, remove any live drums, and we'll do it just with samples. And it was almost like
there was a bit of a bad Beastie Boys or something to start off with this kind of rapping that was a little bit Dr. Octagon kind of lyrics and Cool. A big kind of beast. And it was, you know, some cool stuff. But then we did, you know, it was like, let's just make all the Melody samples and use no voice.
Man, how long was that a process of working on that record? How long did it take y'all to make it?
Probably like 18 intense months. But there was like maybe 3 or 4 years of like collecting samples before then and finding your way. And then it's almost like there's this, I mean, there's two sides to it. There's the technical side of how you actually make it with the samplers or whatever that we can talk about. But the other side of like how you think, how, you know, how you conceive it or the feeling behind it is harder to talk about it because it's like we just hit this period of a beautiful flow. And it was really just a love for music and discovery. And when I listen to it now, that's what I can hear. I can hear like a 21-year-old me just so in love with music. Mm-hmm. Sampling and discovering strange old records that I think that joy is just still what people can is infectious.
It definitely comes through.
Yeah, it definitely came through for me. I think, you know, at the time when I discovered you guys, this was when my band Little Brother, we had put out our first record, The Listening, and Amir actually had listed his I guess the top albums he was listening to at the time in Rolling Stone. And so he listed like 50 Cent, Little Brother, and then, you know, the Avalanche Since I Left You. And I was like, all right, if they on the same list with us, I know our shit banging. So these motherfuckers got to have something. so I'm like, all right.
Well, that's how you discovered
it? Straight up, yeah. I mean, I heard of them. That was how I actually listened to them. Like, I had always seen, but like you said, you know, y'all kind of the rock culture and enjoy. So I just thought they were like a rock band. I thought they all was kind of like the Strokes or like,
right,
because that was around that time. You know what I'm saying? I thought it was just that kind of, you know, that rock revival shit that was popping at the time. So I was like, all right, this is just another rock band. But then I heard the album and I hadn't heard anything. I just went into it blind. I was like, all right, well, let me check it out. And man, that shit blew me the fuck away. And the thing about it, like up until that point, you know, introducing by DJ Shadow. I mean, we grew up on Bomb Squad and like Prince Paul and all these guys, Dust Brothers, all those guys doing that kind of collage and paste stuff. But when I heard Introducing, I was like, oh, wow, like this is amazing. And it was something that kind of took it, for me, made it, it felt like y'all really, it made it more emotional. Like that was, I think, maybe the first time sample-based music, instrumental in that way. I was like, man, this is really emotional. But then that was when I heard Introducing. But then when I heard y'all shit, and that damn two hearts and three, four times,
right?
Bro, I played that shit, man. I played the MP3 tags off that motherfucker, bro. Listen, I ran that record in the ground, man. and the thing, you know, when Tony, you were talking about just kind of that spirit of just, you know, of that discovery, the thing that I always liked about all you guys' records is that the way you use the samples, it doesn't feel like in kind of just a bastardized way. It really makes you want to search what you guys use. It makes you more, for me, just as a lover of music, it just made me more curious to know more about the stuff you guys use. And like, even like with Since I Left You, you know, the way it starts is, you know, Since I Left You. But then at the end, when you bring back the "Just Can't Get You Ever Since the Day I Met You,"
it's like a story.
It's a story. I was like, yo, that shit is so fucking dope. So like, how do y'all plot all that shit out? And like, I know the sample you say you use was like the S, you using the S900. Were you tracking it on tape? Was it was it Pro Tools at that time? Like, how were y'all storing all these ideas?
It was like S900, and then we got a S2000, which had more memory. Akai S2000, we were like, "Oh, this is insane! We're going to be able to do anything with this. No stopping us now."
Yeah.
So, and by that, I think by the time we were making Since I Left You, we had a zip drive for the two Akai.
Yeah, the iOmega. Yes, sir. Yeah.
Yeah.
Get the fuck out of here, yo! This is. Yeah.
I know. But it was literally just that and a shitty old turntable and $2 junk store records and
motherfucker, what?
But you know what? The limitation is what is beautiful, because then
that's what drives the ingenuity.
Yeah. And then we had there's an opcode program called Studio Vision. It was a sequencer. It didn't have any audio, but that ran MIDI into the samplers. And so that's how we could sequence the samples. And it was all done like that. And if I came to work again in the morning, like there was nothing on tape, no Pro Tools, so I would have to load it all up again and hear what the song sounded like and to remember, you know, or if I wanted to burn a demo, make a demo, I'd have to like bounce it, burn it onto CD, put it in my CD Walkman and go for a walk or something to have a listen to it. Like that, where we're at. Yeah.
I was going to ask, do you have all the discs saved from that album, or was it just like once you track it and once it's on tape or once it's recorded, then you just unplugged your machine and that's it? You don't save the samples, you don't any of those things. Like, is there a like, if I were to ask you, like, could you get the either Diners Only
the stems from whatever,
yeah, Pablo Cruz, like, could you actually get the floppy disk?
Some of them I've got some, and I've kept most of the records when I sold my record collection, but I kept all the Since I Left You ones. And we just found the stems recently from, because we eventually tracked it to an early version of Pro Tools when we went to like a proper studio. We were like, wow, this is like, and they had like about four different engineers helping us to like get it from this, from out the back of our samplers onto recording into Pro Tools, and then we mixed it from there. So we've got those stems and some of the floppy disks.
Okay, so what is the accurate number? I know that, you know, sometimes these stories can be exaggerated. How many samples do you believe are on that album?
I've got no idea. I reckon there would be, like, I think I figured it out once by working out how much the S5000 could store and how many samples in a program, and because it was every song was, you know, the sampler memory was full. Mm-hmm. So it was probably like around 3,000 because all the little drum hits and little bird noises or
Yo, I will say, man, when y'all use the part that got me, because, like, I mean, I listened to the record, I was like, okay, that's dope. The part where I realized, I'm like, okay, they know what's up. When y'all use the Raekwon,
the
Avalanche Rock, and I was like, shit. I was like, yes.
Yeah.
That shit was so dope.
Yeah, so your guess, like, I've read 900 samples, I've read 4,000 samples. I mean, of course, for the legend of it, 4,000 samples is a way better thing. And I believe, you know, I believe anything, but baseball estimate.
I think 2,000 to 3,000, like when you consider every little drum hit and everything, it was a lot.
So, okay, when you guys are at least at the, let's say the 90% mark, let's say that you have 15 songs down already. As you're creating this album, in your mind, are you like, there's no way in hell we can ever clear this or sell this to the outside world? Like, I mean, at this rate, is it just a passion project to you?
Yeah.
I think but I think we were just thinking not even of the legality of the whole thing. We were just like trying to put together this amazing thing, and David was just gonna, record company, you do your thing and just get it out. So it was good for us because we didn't have that limitation. Whereas now we're you know, we have to be more aware of samples we use and, you know, clearing and all that kind of stuff. But back then it was still a little bit of a free-for-all, I guess, would you say, Robbie?
Yeah, but also nobody knew who we were. Like,
we didn't
think anyone would ever, you know, it would get a wide audience. So in that way, we were free to do whatever, to sample whatever we wanted, you know. Like, we kind of just didn't really, like, I think as it was growing, we knew we were very passionate and we knew that it was this beautiful thing, but we certainly didn't expect it to become what it was. So we weren't restrained by thinking that, you know, we have a high profile and a lot of people are going to hear this record.
We've done an EP before that as well and didn't clear one sample from it. Yeah. So we just kind of like didn't care.
Must be nice. Man, listen. All right, so.
We can't do that anymore.
Yeah, when I was going to ask, so when people came to y'all about, you know, samples and stuff, what was it like? Were they like honored? Were they like, fuck you, pay me? Like, what was the what was the feeling like?
Back then it was pretty nice. I mean, some people didn't even know what sampling was, or, you know, we would track down someone who they'd inherited like their grandfather's catalog, you know, in a Willis. They didn't even know they had it. And we would find them and say, hey, you know, you own this music. And and some people just were like a flat out no, like Rodgers and Hammerstein and people like that.
So there's songs that did not make it?
Samples that didn't make it, yeah. And then other people like John Cale, like he was super cool because like that song, Two Hearts in 3/4 Time, it was going to work out that like there was five main samples and they all wanted 20% each, so we were going to get nothing. And John Cale was like, no, the sample owners should all take a little bit less so the dudes that made the song can get a little bit too. And so
What?
That's what's up.
Wait a minute. Cool. No, wait, that never happens.
That never. That's probably never happened again.
Never happened again.
Can y'all represent us, please? Wait a minute. This never ever happens in real life, yo.
This is being unknown in Australia.
I mean, I got people that like come after me for like a snare drum.
Yeah.
Like,
yes.
Let alone and want like 70% of it. That's a snare drum. Okay, so when you're this was on XXL Recordings, correct?
XL in UK, yeah, in a label.
XXL. Logic. I'm sorry, forgive me. XL Recordings. So when you played the final product to your company, how long did it take for them to even start the process to clear this? Because again, like usually okay. So the obstacles that I run into are, okay, say I create a song and I have this situation once where I used Hey Bulldog by the Beatles.
Yeah.
And they wanted like 100% of the publishing, which then left no space for like the other things I sampled. And I've learned at least in the last 10 years that relationships are key to making these things happen. And oftentimes lawyers and red tape, lawyers and administrative people are kind of the demons of the situation. And half the time, if you can get to the actual artists themselves, then you can, you know, sort of iron out and make it smooth. So again, how?
we had this amazing lady called Pat Shanahan, who, I mean, she would have been in her 60s or 70s. She just passed away recently. So she would clear all our samples for us, and she'd done like Beastie Boys records and Ice-T and all stuff like that. So she used to work at Island Records for many years and had a lot of contacts just through the whole industry. So when we were clearing a sample, she would be like, hey, I know him, I used to work with him at here, or I know. So she had a lot of personal relationships with all these
relationships,
people.
Okay.
Yeah, so that helped us so much. And she would just be able to get things over the line for us that you know, if it was a lawyer or anything or anyone else like that, it just wouldn't have happened. So we were so lucky to have her for that record.
She's a wonderful
and the one after.
Lady and
yeah.
She became a dear friend actually, Pat. She was just the most lovely lady. And I think she worked with, who did she work at before Island? I can't remember, but she sort of knew everybody in the industry since like the 60s and had seen that there was a niche for someone who just specifically cleared samples. And so I think she left the record label, and then the first record she cleared was like the Tone Loc record or something like that. And then she did Ice-T and then she did Beck and the Beastie Boys. And yeah, so she helped us a lot. And then there were other personal relationships like Richard Russell at XL helped us clear the Madonna sample.
Second track. That was to be, even when I heard it in the car. Now, my story of hearing it, I heard that album on my birthday. I was doing a DJ gig in Indiana, and I was born in January, so it was like cold. And the guy that picked me up from the airport played it. And, you know, because the album runs sort of as a continuous flow, like it doesn't go from song to song. I just thought he was, you know, normally when the guy picks me up from the airport, they're always like sneaking their demos
trying to play their beats and shit.
Right, exactly. So,
can't blame them.
Yeah, no. But for real, from the airport to my hotel room, I was under the impression he was playing me his shit. And that just, that had me wide open. And then, like, finally he gave me the bad news 20 minutes into it, like, oh, no. This is some cats from Australia called the Avalanches. I was like, oh, man, I thought it was your shit. All right, never mind.
I was just about to sign you, man.
Right.
What wound up happening, I asked him, can I borrow the CD so I could hear it? And, like, actually, the same story with Little Brother. When I heard Fonte's thing, like, I rarely have dedicated so much hours, a lot of hours just to listen to product over and over and over again. And I just couldn't believe it. Well, because you guys worked on, and what you said earlier about how studio limitations makes you more creative, that makes sense. Cause a lot of my favorite guys like use, you know, with Fonte's group, what did you guys do? Everything on Fruity Loops?
Everything was Fruity Loops and a compact. We had a compact computer.
Yeah, and that was Fruity the Loops album. And, yeah. You know, I know guys.
Kool-Aid Pro. Like, that was what we recorded the vocals in, Kool-Aid Pro.
Or Sony Acid, like something real primitive. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what I want to know is how do you bend samples to your will melodically, especially back then, without, you know, the aid of a MacBook Pro? To instantly, you know, you could do that
time stretching and
time stretching in like 30 seconds.
Mm-hmm. But yeah. How are you able to bend these samples to your will so that they melodically fit the song and with that primitive equipment? How?
I think it comes back to what you're saying about just how limitations can be really powerful, because it was just like, I just remember going, this Akai sampler, I'm just going to get really fucking good at this one thing, and that's all I'm going to do, you know. And so once it just becomes almost invisible, so you're not even thinking about how to use it. You know it so well. And so it was just literally tuning samples in the sampler. So, you know, you might have start with a drum beat and kind of a beginning sample, and the beginning sample just kind of gets you going. It might not even be there at the end. But then it's just literally getting samples in tune and a whole bunch of samples just on the MIDI keyboard that are living in the sampler's memory and playing around and then going, oh, that might be a verse, that might be a chorus. Oh, I'm kind of stuck, save it, put it away, maybe give it to Tony. He'll see if he can find a sample for it. And slowly the layers build up. So it's just using your ear, tuning samples by ear.
So
yeah. That is not easy to do, people. That is not easy to do.
Which leads to my next question. So when I asked the Bomb Squad how they created Nation of Millions, I guess Keith Shockley explained to me that basically the process that they were doing, they would have jam sessions. So the way that the engineer was set up was Eric Sattler had his sampler on his side of the room. Keith Shockley was probably on turntable doing his stuff. And then Hank would have his bits, and they would start with a drum beat. And when they were satisfied, their theory was that if you took everything away, like, are the drums banging enough? Like, the drums have to be perfect. Once the drums are there, then each chef would add their particular ingredient into the musical stew until it felt complete and felt right. So how do you guys source, or like, what's the back and forth or the work process to adding things? Like, you know, whose idea was it? Like, oh, I got this horse noise over here, or even with the first song on Wildflower where the kid is talking. I don't know if that's a sound bite, and you guys manipulated his voice to go right in key with that intro. But, you know, even with the Wildflower intro, like, how do you guys communicate back and forth, like, what gets inside the meal, and also subsequently, how do you tell each other that doesn't work? Like, okay, I don't know if that fits or whatever. Or is it just like whatever works, throw it in there?
I think definitely Robbie is the great producer of the records. And it's almost like where, you know, we used to have all the other members in the band and we, you know, have a little sample, you know, loops, a couple of things that would go together or something like that, but then kind of give them over to him where he's putting it all together and, you know, chopping up everything. And, I mean, it's just what he's amazing at is just doing all the layers and the incredible production work and, you know, the horse noises and all that kind of thing.
Horse noise, man. I was just like, the hell?
It was like DJ Muggs and Cypress Hill, and you know, that squeal noise he had.
Yeah,
and
I was like,
I'm going to try and make a noise like that. And then I was just watching an old Western movie and there was this horse. I was like, that might work. So
how'd you get the horse to clear the sample?
Exactly.
At first, man.
The horse to this day still doesn't know that he's on the record.
No.
Okay. Well, not just with music. How did you guys even know? Because movie sound bites are also a big part of the structure here. How did you guys even source or even figure out clearing all of the non-musical elements of the song that had to be cleared? Like, I'm certain that with movie dialogue, or was it just like the Wild West? Like, if they come to you, then you admit it, or... Never mind.
Please don't incriminate yourself.
I think. Never mind. I got my answer.
We're pleading.
This is Questlove Supreme, not DJ Blast.
Oh my God! Don't never compare me to him.
Would you like our answer or the record label's answer?
Never mind. Never mind. Forget it.
One thing I was curious to know. For two things. One, just the making of Wildflower, because, you know, we've read a lot, and if you guys have talked a lot about the making of Since I Left You. Wildflower was like, other than D'Angelo's Black Messiah, those were neck and neck. Those were like my two most anticipated records of that decade.
It took just as long.
And I remember we've been hearing about it for a while, and I was like, it dropped, and I was like, holy shit, this is really here. And, you know, it was really inspiring to me because it sounded like you guys picked up like right where you left off. It didn't even, you could listen to Since I Left You and Wildflower back to back. And aside from the cameos, you know, you would sound like they were done at the same time. So I was curious to know just, you know, working on that record and, you know, what took so long from Since I Left You to Wildflower, and two, you guys picking your MCs, because you really pick, you know, guys that weren't, you know, like, you know, Danny Brown and Camp Lowe, and you know what I mean? Like, you guys work with some kind of unorthodox people. So how do y'all go about choosing that?
Camp Lowe, that first Camp Lowe, Uptown Saturday Night was like our all-time favorite record. We'll just play that non-stop, and some great sampling in that record too. So, and we actually sampled Camp Lowe on Since I Left You. So it was really nice to kind of go full circle and then work with them.
Whenever we played live, we'd always have a bit where Luchini would come in after a song. So we're massive Camp Lowe fans.
That's what's up.
Before you answer Fonte's question, how did you guys deliver the album live? Like, how does that even happen? Or what's the I only saw you guys when you guys finally came to the Tonight Show for the Wildflower album. That's the first time I got to see you like actually perform. But when you made Since I Left You, then how do you decide how to deliver this in concert?
When we were touring Since I Left You, we were still like in live band mode, because we still had that element from, you know, when we were starting out. So we would sort of do like kind of like, it was like a big party with live drums and kind of like, I don't know.
Bass guitar, Since I Left You, some keys.
Yeah.
But most of everything was just like on a MIDI keyboard, and we'd have the samples that would just be that key. chorus, break, horse. Yeah, yeah. So it was just triggering live, yeah. And then the drummer playing along to it. So there's no, like, you know, time code or anything into a computer or anything like that when we did tour since I left you. So it was still pretty organic in that way.
One of the guys in your band, man, homie, I'm a big fan of, Jonty. How did y'all hook up, and what's his role in you guys' band?
Oh yeah, he was part of our touring group for around the Wildflower era. Mm. And we came and did Coachella, yeah. And I think we heard his first EP and it was really cool. And then he did some vocals on Wildflower. Mm-hmm. And then we're like, come on the road. Yeah.
And but he also did Since I Left You, he put a band together of about 15 musicians and played Since I Left You front to back.
Really?
And did it live around Australia. And we were like, oh, let's go check this out. And it was kind of like really weird to just be, you know, we hadn't played for so long, and we're just like, hey, we should get back on the road and like do this ourselves. But it was really cool to see. And from there, I mean, you know, we developed a relationship.
He's really dope. I'm a big fan of his, man. Yeah, but the gap between the first album and Wildflower, you know, that 18 years, 16 years, whatever. What happened?
I gotta admit, I thought they threw you guys under the jail. I really admit, I was like, oh, they got thrown under the jail. Oh, you ain't got our money? Fuck it, y'all go to jail.
I mean, there's many ways to answer that question, but the short answer is like, you know, you make Since I Left You with no money, no equipment. You have a success, you get an advance to make your second record, you buy all this equipment, but it doesn't flow and it doesn't happen.
Imagine you're lost.
Sitting there messing around with compressors all day and like outboard gear. And we had none of that before. And it took a long time to get back to that point of realizing it's not about that. It's just about your imagination, a turntable and a sampler. And you can add all that shit later in the studio. But it was like, you've got to write the songs, the beautiful songs first, you know, and all the gear in the world doesn't help you. Well, you know, we were young and we had to learn that ourselves. And now we're back to like, I don't have a studio in my house anymore. Like, I just back to the same simple
basic equipment
I started with.
So you purposely wanted to go back to square one.
Yeah. It took us 16 years to realize that. But eventually, and the thing is like in all honesty, as the time went on, kind of Since I Left You started to grow in stature. So we were, a lot of pressure started to build. And then that pressure, you know, came a little bit from the record company, just from fans in general and everything. When's it going to happen? And that got to us a lot as well, I think, as it went along. Mm-hmm. And then like Robbie said, we kind of just got back to the essence of what it was all about. And almost just in our own personal journeys, kind of decluttered our minds and stopped with all the pressure within ourselves and just let go of all that, let go of all the equipment. And from that point, like, it didn't take that long at all to finish.
Yeah. I'm just curious, what equipment did you use for Wildflower and the new one specifically? The same?
No, we used Pro Tools for this one. We were using Vision for Since I Left You, which that program actually, they stopped making it in 1997. So, and Robbie was still using that up to 2016.
Yeah. Hey, if it ain't broke.
Exactly. How long did it take you to learn how to master updated equipment? Or were you just stubborn, like, I'll never, if it's this or nothing?
I was stubborn for a long time.
I didn't want to say that.
But now I'm just like, it's Pro Tools, and I just edit in Pro Tools, and it's just like second nature to me again. So it's just like a tape recorder, and it reminds me of like when I was like 15 and learning how to make tape loops and stuff. You know, it's like, as long as I keep it simple, you know, it's cool. So.
What are the pros and cons to, you know, in Pro Tools, you're now able to see your music and your samples, and back in the day you couldn't. So what are the advantages and disadvantages to that? if any?
That's an amazing question, because you're so right. I mean, you can't see the waveforms in the sampler. You know, you don't see, you're just listening and you're kind of like looking at the window almost, you know. So it's just a feeling thing. And it has been a big change because, you know, Pro Tools can grid everything so easily and everything can get tight. And like,
you can make so many different versions of the one song. And it's almost like you can, again, get too out of control with limitlessness of things like Pro Tools. And even just going back to Wildflower, the way, you know, we used to sample, just pick up a record, put it on, find a sample from it, you know, put a beat, simple like that. But during Wildflower, we just for some reason would go, okay, let's just, you know, collect samples. So we just collect samples without, like, thousands, and categorize them without even really making songs. We're just like, we'll do that later. So it almost became like this
storing
administration process of making music. So that, just that the limitlessness of that 16 is
16 years
is
later, we're like, that doesn't work.
Yeah, it's not working.
Yeah, I was going to ask, just in the 16 years, you know, between those records, what were you guys' main source of income? Like, how was y'all able to stay gone for that long?
It was a struggle, you know, and it's certainly not what people think. It's like, you know, being in a band. And like, for example, the song since, like, talking about sample clearance, like the song Since I Left You is like, I don't own any of it. You know, it's all owned by samples. So we don't get really royalties to live off. So it was tough. And we would get offers to do some big shows in that time. But we kind of thought, you know, if it gets to like 2010 and we haven't put a new record out, we don't really want to go and do a show because it just seems like we're
an oldies at
rehashing.
Yeah. I mean, you know, maxing out credit cards.
It was tough.
Well, were you guys, did you ever opt or consider like just going back to your roots and DJing, like just doing DJ sets as a duo, but without the pressure of here's our new album, that sort of thing?
We did that a few times, and that was able to earn us some income.
Okay.
We did like a couple of songs for a musical. It was a King Kong musical that was here in Melbourne, so that kind of helped. So, and we did have a lot of help from the record company,
right?
Who had just signed to, so it was like an independent record company who had just like been
bought
out, half bought out by Universal,
okay,
which has a lot of money. So you know, our man there, Steve Pav, would really help us out by constantly asking them if we can have a little bit more and say, it's just around the corner, you know, 6 months away. 6 months later, it'd be the same thing. So
finesse.
Wow. He was wonderful, actually.
Yeah, he was really good with all that.
I always wanted to know. Okay, so I'm probably closer to Robbie's theory on kind of staying intentionally ignorant to technology so that it doesn't destroy me. Mm-hmm. You know, like I don't that's my excuse. Like, I don't want to learn all this technology because then I'll lose what I had in my magic period, that sort of thing. But I have to know, so when I first saw the demonstration of, I hope I'm saying this right, and I prefaced all that to say, like, I really don't know the technical terms, but with the program Melodyne, that enables you to sort of like erase the DNA of a song. Like if I could take a Stevie Wonder song and erase his vocals out of it and make it just an instrumental, that sort of thing. When I first saw that, I saw it at Jazzy Jeff's house, and the first thing I said to him was, yo, like, I can't wait to see what happens when the Avalanches get a hold of this machine where they can now really manipulate and bend sounds to the, you know. To
or like y'all world. On, or like Ableton, like the Avalanches with Ableton. It's like, that's fucking scary.
Exactly. So, like, have you guys even created songs to that level? Like, it's weird. I don't know if someone has fully taken advantage of, like, it's to me, it seems so grandiose and so intimidating that I haven't even, I think maybe once last year I decided like, all right, let me take the Fender Rhodes from this particular song that I don't have the stems to and see if I could build a song from that. But besides that one moment, like I kind of thought it was going to be just a flood of kind of a return, or at least a part two of the sample Wild Wild West that was, you know, 86 to 92, that sort of thing. But what this sort of sampling, have you guys even decided or considered that level of sampling where you start erasing the DNA of samples that exist to create new material? I hope I asked that question right.
Yeah, totally.
Okay.
Totally did. It feels like it's a strange kind of
concept. I also feel like it's a
concept.
A crime. So
A little bit.
I feel every time I use it, I asked someone last week to like, you know, extract some vocals from a song. And even then I felt guilty. So my heart wasn't into making it. It'll start off innocent now with just music, but then who knows like what they'll use it for 30 years from now with identity theft. So I think I'm kind of scared of jumping in that pool because I feel like this is the beginning of the danger period. But what is your relationship with that level of technology and sampling?
I don't think we've thought about it too much. I know we bought Melodyne maybe 3 years ago and I personally haven't used it once. We were like, yeah, it's going to be great. I kind of looked at it and went, no, not now. But I don't know. I feel like that's kind of, in a way, dishonoring the sample and the people who played on it. And I don't know, maybe that's just kind of an old fashioned attitude. And then the future is just going to be like taking out, you know, Stevie.
So there's never that one song you were like, man, if I could just get rid of the vocals on that.
We try and do that with filters, but who knows what the future holds. I don't know how Robbie thinks about that, but
I don't know. Like, I think there's some cool stuff, like what you mentioned, Ableton and stuff, like being able to stretch a sample like a really, really, really far, way further than we ever could. Like, we've done some of that kind of stuff. But I also love, you know, the art form of like say the vocal sample for Since I Left You has got music underneath. We just had to filter it and then I had to chop it very finely, but you can still hear all these little bells and stuff. And it all adds to this sort of magic, even though it's out of tune and stuff. It's like, it's kind of beautiful that way too. You know, I think things would get quite clean and really like pristine sounding if you can like forensically remove elements, but I don't know if it would still have the magic.
And it'd take away like the layers that you don't necessarily hear, but you feel. And then if you do take them away, you're like, hang on, something's missing here, but I can't tell what it is.
That's the thing with like sample based music. It's just so like, even when like trying to replay stuff or, you know, and it's just like, dude, when you sample something, you're not just sampling that song, you're sampling that day, you're sampling the engineer, you're sampling the outboard gear. You know, there's so many things that made it what it was. And when you start manipulating that, a lot of times you can kind of get too far away from home to where you lose the magic.
And that's like a spirit in the music.
Absolutely.
Yeah, engineers should get paid for samples.
Shut up, Steve.
Yeah, that's real rap. I'm going to start a petition.
Sugar Network.
Hey, another question that I have. I have a theory, but I want to see if I'm correct. What was the inspiration for the Wildflower album cover?
It was that Sly Stone cover.
I knew it.
Yeah.
When I first saw it, I was like, wow. When I first saw it, I was like, wow. Like in an alternative world where Sly was happy with his life and everything was going swimmingly, this would have been the album cover to There's a Ride Going On.
Yeah.
And always, wow. Okay.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And we actually got it, found a world quilting champion who she lives in Nebraska and she quilted that cover for us and we just took a photo of it. So we wanted it to look real like the Sly cover, you know.
Wow. So that's an actual quilt. Yeah, she made that.
Yeah, that's a quilt.
What?
Oh, shit.
No, I thought it was animated. You see? Oh my God, you're right. I'm looking at it right now. Who wow. who has
one
the
of y'all
original?
Own it? I'm about to say, yeah, who got it?
Yeah.
He still sleeps with it on his bed.
You do? Congratulations, Robbie. I will be coming there for it.
Yo, man, I wanted to ask y'all on the new record, man, bruh, where did y'all find Terrence Trent D'Arby?
Yo, dog.
Like, for real. Dude. I mean, he's Sananda Montreal. That's, you know, what he goes by. He's been going by for the past few years. But, yeah,
how
I
did
was
you find
so
him?
Happy.
I can't remember how we got in touch, but we had this song, and Tony and myself and our collaborator on this record, Andy, it was like this beautiful piece of music. We had this Vashti Bunyan vocal, and it was honestly not going to make the record because it was like, there's just no voice that can fit. And I can't remember, one day it was Tony and myself, we just had this idea, and we were like, we wonder if we could ever get in touch with him or if he would know who we are. And somebody got in touch with Sananda, and it's been honestly the most incredible, one of the most beautiful experiences of my life. He's the warmest.
Okay, so the
I was afraid of the answer. I didn't know.
He is incredible.
Incredible.
Dude. He's been so open-hearted and just so generous with his time. That's probably the most beautiful thing, that like people just don't dial in a vocal and here you go. It's like so generous with their time to go back and forth and really get something that feels like it was meant to be there, you know.
His emails,
so y'all actually track that together. Y'all track that together, or would he track it on his side?
Tracked it on his side, but there was a lot of back and forth with emails and stuff. And his emails are an absolute joy to read. It's it is he's so eccentric but smart and expressive in his emails, and he's just like Robbie go, we got a new email from Sananda, and I go, send it, I want to read it. It's like a highlight. it was amazing to read. And then
poetry, really, you know, beautiful.
Real poetry. And just listening to his voice, it's like, it is one of the great voices, in my opinion, of all time.
It is still
incredible. Like, I listen to that song and I still just go, what a vocal performance. It's incredible.
So on the other side, I guess maybe the polar opposite.
That,
Tricky, what was that like? Working with him.
That was
I love him, man. I love Tricky.
Actually, we should have mentioned when we're talking about 90s sample music too, like his first record.
Massive Attack. Like, oh, yeah, Max and Kaya.
Yeah, exactly. And so that was stuff that was filtering through to us from England at the time too. So it was like he was one of our heroes, you know, and the Massive Attack records. And he was in Berlin making a record. He just put that record out last year. It's a really great record. And he was just like... I happen to be in the studio right now. What have you got? And we would just send him a song, the first song. The next morning, you know, came back with full lyrics. And then he was like, that was great. Send me another one. And we ended up, that went on for like 2 weeks. We did like 8 songs together.
Hey.
and then we got like a message from his management to our management, who didn't know anything about this. And they were like, are you guys recording together? What, you've made half a record. What's going on? Like, we need to do some paperwork. he was on a hot streak making that record. So he was like, anything you can send me, I'm on fire at the moment.
Wow.
And it is so good when it's just the artist to artist as well, and it's not going through. So, you know, the management obviously didn't know it was happening or whatever. And we were just doing our own thing without all that. And it's that's, you know, such a rewarding relationship for us to kind of, you know, but have that situation with people we grew up listening to and our heroes and everything. And I think you get just so much of a more pure product when it's not, you know, through their people and all that stuff.
Yeah, like you guys, the people y'all pick, man, I can't front. Like, it is pretty much, I mean, it's like a dream, you know, just me being just the music nerd I am. Like, the people you get on every record, I'm like, yo, like, that was a perfect fit. And when I saw that it was, you know, Terrence Trent D'Arby, he was on this one, and then Tricky. But when I saw that y'all got fucking Cornelius, I was like, yo, dude, like, yeah, they've been in my iTunes or some shit. Like, y'all must know. Like, what was, I'm like, dude, they picking all my guys. So what was he like, man? What was it like working with him?
But I don't know what to say about Kago really. He's like, he's a dear friend, and we met him like in 2001 or something, because he put out that album,
Phantasma. Yeah.
And we were making Since I Left You, listening to that album, just going, this is...
Yeah, so Mic Check, that was my shit.
Mic Check, exactly, yeah, and the break beats, but it's kind of like Disney.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, yeah.
Exactly. Yes, because Tokyo's only like same time zone as here in 10 hours, we go a lot to DJ, and so we've become friends over the years, and he'll always show us like record stores and everything. He's this sweetest guy. And then he just happened to be in Los Angeles doing a show when we were there recording, so that song just came about like,
and it was Robbie's birthday, it was my birthday at the time.
Yeah,
but the recording with him was
happy birthday.
The recording with him was so incredible, the process, because we kind of had the beat just going, and he just had a guitar there, and he'd be like, all right, let's do some takes, and just, you know, and it just roll around. And so we'd sit there and go,
that's it.
Then the next take. And then it just all started layering up that you got that we're all like, okay. And then towards the end, everyone's like, oh, we understand now. Like, so he had this whole thing in his head that was like 12 layers of different guitar tracks that he was just like making. And it just, that's how the song came about.
No, that's him.
Yeah, that's so incredible to watch. It was so impressive.
Phantasma, that fucked me up when I heard it. And then the one that, like, when I think it was after I graduated college, when he came with Point, like, I still play that record. Like, you know, I love that album, man. He's a nut. I love it.
Yeah. Hey, can I ask, what was it like working with Johnny Marr?
That was another one that was done remotely. But I still remember the morning, actually, that...
you didn't get the nerd out on any Smith's questions or...
Oh, my goodness. I think we would have overwhelmed him, I think, in Smith's questions.
Yeah, when he came to sit in with us, like, I think that's probably the only time that we really nerded out on, like, tell us more stories, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah. But we actually met, we saw him even before we approached him to play on the track. We were like, he was at the next table at us at Fuji Rock Festival, like just backstage, and we were both just going, go up to him and ask him. No, you go up. Come on, say something. Ask if he wants to be in. And for about 15 minutes, we tried to psych each other up to go up to him, and in the end, we were just like, no, we can't do it. But we got in contact eventually, and he was really great. And he actually sent us a message after The Divine Call, which is the song he's on. It kind of got some play in England. And he's like, thanks, guys. My kids think I'm cool again now.
Oh, no. Nice. Hey, have you guys even considered or thought about releasing like all instrumental versions of the last two records?
No.
Just for the Avalanche purist or whatever, like just to hear it. Because sometimes I know that you guys are going through a progression and you hear the metamorphosis of the group sort of blooming. But so there's not an instrumental mixed version of any of this stuff out there?
No, but we have them.
We have them. Yeah. I think everything we do,
sorry.
we can send them over.
Send it to me. Okay, great. Right.
That's really what the fuck you wanted to ask.
Yeah, exactly.
Is that what this interview's about?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just wanted to see them. Now, do you guys ever think that you'll try to do another all instrumental project? As far as I know, you're probably working on something now. And I just don't
Yeah,
know,
we're but, starting another yeah. record now. I think, yeah, because it's just like, I mean, working with vocalists like that for us is almost like, it's still, you know, an act of curation and almost sampling in a way. But I feel like we're making a slight turn back towards just a sample based record.
Well, whatever the next record is, I'm putting my bid in. I won't in on that motherfucker. So I'm late.
Same.
Hey, listen, man. Even if it's just an interlude, just talking. Yeah. Whatever. Yeah.
Let's do it.
Man, Dude, I almost feel like this is probably the least that I've inserted questions in an interview, only because I feel like every question that I want to know the answer to is almost like inconsequential, like just, okay, that particular snare that you use on this song versus the frog noises from this thing. Wait, I do want to know who decides the concept for your videos?
Man.
Especially with Frankie Sinatra, like, or just all your videos. All your videos are just some next level shit. Like, who comes with those concepts?
It's mainly the video people. So we get pitched some things, and then we kind of, I guess, just pick the craziest one.
Really?
Yeah, but I was Frankie Sinatra. I met. I hope this doesn't sound bad, but we actually had a Zoom or a Skype with the producers who were going to be shooting the video, and they were French, and like we struggled to understand what.
You're just like, do whatever you want to do, guys. You're French. So we were doing.
Okay, it kind of sounds good.
But they seemed like lovely people, so we were
okay. So sweet, and the lady had this beautiful voice. It was almost like a movie. Like, it was just, my songs were horrible. And we were like, oh, what? Cool.
Okay, this, yeah, whatever.
Sounds good. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Wow. Wow.
Can I ask one more question?
Mm-hmm.
So, in messing with loops and samples and beats and things like movie dialogue and horses and everything that you end up creating your music with, how often do you go in with an idea? I'm going for something specific, but then as Questlove and I and constantly talking about, some kind of happy accident happens and ends up being better than your original idea. Or different, and how often does that play into what we hear in the final product?
It happens all the time. Really, that's almost the whole thing. Like, you know, we will talk about like where we want to try and go next, but you can't predict the mood you're going to be in and the record you're going to be sampling at that time, and maybe just one little like bit of atmosphere at the end of someone's song or something, it's like, and you're just in the right mood to hear how you could flip that moment.
That's the catalyst.
If you put something in the wrong spot, and then if you put it a beat behind or something, and suddenly you're a rhythmic genius.
Exactly.
But that's also like our friendship too. It's like having to be able to tell each other that, you know, that thing you made yesterday morning in 5 minutes is better than the thing you spent a month on when you had this big concept. And, you know, you just captured some magic there, and we should roll with that, you know.
I think that was also part of Wildflower too, is like that magic of the 5 minute finding the great loop and everything. And then we would just layer and layer and layer. And in the end, the initial thing is like this much of something that's like that. And then we went through a process towards the end of you know, making it, where we just took a lot of that away and this started to shine again.
Hmm.
So I don't know. Yeah.
That's so dope. Kurt Vile, man. How did y'all hook up with him? His record, He's All Right. That's like, I love that song and I always dug him. How did y'all hook up?
That was like the last song we finished for the record. And once again, it was a beautiful piece of music, but I just play his records like all the time. So huge fan. And we just reached out.
He's Philly.
Yeah, I was about to say, he's from my town.
We just reached out on Instagram. He was like down for it. Oh, I think he might have messaged us about something else in the past. And then we're like, we've got this song. And he just did this beautiful kind of like poetic rambling spoken word thing. That was beautiful. I still remember the day that arrived, actually. It was like really
I like. I remember the day that Robbie played it to me after he put the vocals into the track. And we'd had that track for a long time. And it was just kind of like, what do we do with it? Like, is it a melodic kind of thing? And then he played me the thing that Kurt did. And I was just like, play it again. And he played it again. And I just went, that's done. That's perfect. That's exactly what it needs. You know, just one of those things where you're like, you don't have to and ah about it. It's like, oh, we have to change it around a little bit. Or maybe if we cut this bit, perfect. It just felt so good. And it was just like, that's it. That's done.
Yeah. What made y'all come back? Because I'm going to be real with you. I was surprised to see that we got Avalanche's album in 2020. Because after Wildflower, I was expecting, all right, well, it'll be another 10 years before we get up. I was ready to wait it out, but y'all came back. I was like, all right, what led to the, I guess, the quicker turnaround in records? Like, where are y'all at now in your lives where y'all can kind of turn around a little quicker?
I think we're just freed up from the long 16-year, you know, we felt the pressure to follow up since I left you. And then once we made another really great sample-based record in Wildflower that we felt like, you know, that was a really worthy follow-up to Since I Left You, we just felt free. And, you know, we just got back to the very simple flow of creating and not overthinking, and it's just flowing really quickly. We've already got a bunch more songs as well. And
it's so fun to be an actual touring band and not, you know, broke musicians in our houses working on a record for 16 years. And, you know, we play Coachella and we're doing Glastonbury and we're like, what? We should have been doing this 10 years ago. So that's inspiration for us. And
bring me my money. I love it.
Wait, my last question about a guest on your record. What was the process of like working with Rivers Cuomo?
Weezer, yeah.
And did you resist any Pinkerton fan out moments, or just, you know?
That was so cool. And I think we grew up loving, like, you know, we have a love for like the Beach Boys, and he's someone who I can hear that in his music, and he's like, can write such an amazing pop hook.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, Tony can tell the story, but I think we'd already tracked the song, and then he was in Melbourne. Did we meet him beforehand, Tony, or after?
No, he'd sent us like the vocal. So he had like sent a spreadsheet with three different lyric paragraphs.
He had spreadsheets of all his hooks, like just in a spreadsheet laid out.
And he was like, choose one. We need to hear the melodies. Like, we want to hear how it goes. So he's like, okay. And he set the melodies for each, you know, little lyric thing he had. And
so he just sends you a whole bunch of hooks and you could choose one?
He sent three.
No one does that.
No, not at all.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
So in the end, we were just like, they're all really good. Can we have them all? So we worked them all into the track eventually, and you know, like the outro and the verse and the chorus, and so that made up the three different things. But and so we ended up meeting him in Melbourne, and like they were supporting the Foo Fighters at like a big stadium, and we're like, okay, we'll go. So Robbie and I spent a day like looking at all the coolest bars to take him in Melbourne, and you know, you want to impress him and do all these really cool things. And in the end, it was raining, and all he wanted to do was, like, we got some umbrellas from the hotel. He just wanted to walk around the city in the rain. And then we stopped at a Starbucks and had a coffee and spoke for about an hour and then went back to the hotel. So I was like, oh, okay, I guess we won't be going to this cool bar where there's, like, you know, all the girls and all this crazy shit going on. We'll just sit in Starbucks. But in that way, it was, like, perfect.
Well, actually, wait. Speaking of your Beach Boys fandom, Assuming that the woman who worked with you for sample clearances is the same lady that cleared the samples for Paul's Boutique. I don't know which album she did it for, but I would assume it's Paul's Boutique because there's a lot of samples. Were you guys even aware of Brian Wilson's hip-hop album that was produced by the Dust Brothers?
Is this a trick question? Does not know about this. Are you serious?
I guess the story is that, you know, at the time when the Beastie Boys first signed to Capitol, I guess Brian Wilson had gotten a copy of Paul's Boutique and was kind of impressed because they explained to him like how the album was made and how all these samples and that sort of thing. He was really impressed by it. So he hit up the Dust Brothers and said, I too want to do an album. And he wound up making I think they made like five or six songs together. And one of them, I think, was called Smart Girls or whatever. But it's
now,
like,
this is Brian. He rapping or it's just?
Yeah.
It's just, boy.
I think if you YouTube it.
No.
I'm gonna check this out.
Yeah, wait.
You're messing with me.
No. Because the thing is that every time I tell the story, I'm like, wait a minute. I know for starters that I actually talked to Brian Wilson about this in person, and I talked to the Dust Brothers. But even in my mind, I'm like, wait, did I imagine that? But
it doesn't seem real.
Wait, is it still on YouTube? Yeah, he did it. He did a song. Okay, so Smart Girls. Yeah, Smart Girls. Capitol rejected the album, but it's still out there. It came out in 1991. And Matt Dyke, like the those guys produced it. And it was the Brian Wilson rap album. It was called Sweet Insanity. Yeah,
I've never heard that in my life.
That seems like a fitting title for it.
Yeah, it is. Guys, I just want to say, I try to keep my cool with guests, you know, half the time on this platform. But yeah, man, I want to thank you guys personally, because I will say that in hearing your record, that's what really planted the seed in my head on how my DJ gigs should go, because I just never thought. I mean, yeah, like I was raised on that certain Bomb Squad type of hip hop that anything could go, but when I heard this album, that's when I realized, like, oh, anything can really happen in a DJ set in a sort of a creative context. So I will say that after hearing your album, and I guess I heard it in 2000, 2001, like, that's when I just totally wiped the slate clean of what was then my DJ sets. And my whole goal was like, well, I'm just do what the Avalanches do and just throw any and everything in my DJ set, be it something normal, something off kilter, something unorthodox, something, you know, just I thank y'all for that. Like, you guys were definitely the impetus to, like, my DJ rebirth that I've been running away with, like, for the last 20 years, man. But you guys are true geniuses, man. I thank you for doing the show with us.
Oh, man. Thank you. That's really
thank
kind.
Thank you so much.
This has been
so fun.
Oh, thanks. You guys. Thanks.
Really.
All right. Well, are you done?
I was just gonna ask. I guess my last thing. The other artists, like, kind of soul artists in you guys' region. So yeah, Australia. So, like, I'm thinking, of course, Highest Coyote, Fat Freddy's Drop. I know they're kind of more of a ska kind of band. Lisa Kakala. Like, what relationship do you have with that community? The soul, you know, I guess R&B community. What's that like?
Well, we're just like kind of a couple of old men who, like, meet each other on the park bench every day and talk about the weather or whatever. Like, we don't, like, I guess we're often traveling, but we're kind of not really, like,
out and about.
On the scene.
Yeah.
Except that, except to say that there is just, like, it's just a very warm music community here in Melbourne. Yeah. Everybody's very supportive. I think it's maybe because it's so geographically isolated. It's like there's just like it's very supportive anyway. We always feel very supported.
That's what's up.
Yeah.
Steve? Last words.
Yeah, you left me out of the Michelle Obama episode and the Jimmy Fallon episode,
man,
as well.
Anyway.
Great callback.
On behalf of Questlove Supreme, Fonticolo, and Steve, we'd like to thank the Avalanches for kicking it with us. Oh my God, that's
great. Man. I don't think I ever read an interview with y'all, let alone, you know what I'm saying, half interview. Yeah. So this was a dream come true, man. Thank you guys for hanging out.
Oh, thanks.
Thank
you. Fun.
Seriously, it's been so good, so much fun.
All right.
Thank you guys.
Thank you guys on behalf of Fonticolo, Unpaid Bill, and Laia, and Sugar Steve, Questlove, and this is Questlove Supreme. We will see you next week, next go-round. Thank you.
Hey, this is Sugar Steve. Make sure you keep up with us on Instagram at QLS and let us know what you think and who should be next to sit down with us. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast.
What's Love Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.